Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on Christmas Day, we will look into the real meaning of Christmas and what it has to do with the frenzy of materialism that has been underway since Thanksgiving. Best-selling author Frank Schaefer, who previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and focused on the family's James Dobson, before breaking with the religious right his father helped create, joins us. We will discuss the phony war on Christmas that the right wing have created out of thin air as a rally to the support of a fellow Christian, the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty, whose hateful rhetoric they are defending in the name of the prophet of peace and love, whose birthday is being celebrated today. Then we will hear from Sister Ann Kendrick, one of the founders of the Hope Community Center in Apopka, Florida, where she addresses the problems confronting migrant farm laborers in Central Florida. We will discuss how she and the families of mostly undocumented immigrants celebrate Christmas and the gulf between the material wants that overwhelm our culture and the spiritual needs that she ministers to the least among us, as the gulf between the rich and the poor widens in the land of plenty, where just one family has a personal wealth equal to the entire wealth of 40% of all Americans. And joining us now on this Christmas holiday is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma. The nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and Sex, Mum, and God. And his latest book is And God Said Billy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, thanks, Ian.
And on this Christmas holiday, I'd like to talk to you about the God of love and so much hate that spews out in the name of the God of love.
Right.
We've had this recent example of it with the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty reality show on television who made racist and hideously homophobic remarks that Of course, all couched in religion. The show always ends with the family sitting around at the table saying grace, and constantly the program is replete with references to God and religion. And Sarah Palin, of course, has come to their rescue in the name of God. So how do you reconcile that those that believe that they are practitioners of a religion of humility and love can be so hateful?
Well, you know, it's ironic because here we are on Christmas, and of course, one of the one of the bêtes noires of the right is to always go on and on and on about the so-called war on Christmas. But of course, there is actually a war on Christmas, and it's being carried on by people who call themselves Christians and who have so denigrated the name and reputation of Christianity, and therefore by extension Jesus, that they have managed to do what no atheist like Christopher Hitchens or Dawkins or any of these other people could ever dream of doing in terms of discrediting the message of Christianity. You know, when you look, for instance, at Pope Francis and how people have been so eager to hear him talk about something positive in terms of laying off the whipping boys of the evangelical and Roman Catholic right. Here's a pope who hasn't changed doctrine. He hasn't included women in the priesthood. He hasn't said that gay marriage is okay. But just because he comes over as a decent human being with a little bit of humility, a little bit of compassion, even secular folks who are not particularly fond of Christianity or the church are eager for that message. And I think what that shows is that far from there being a secular war on Christmas or a secular war on religion, the reputation of religion has been so damaged, whether it's suicide bombers in the Middle East doing things in the name of Islam or homophobic Christians who just keep going back to this incredible cyclical kind of vision of America where the outsider, whether it's the immigrant or the gay person or the black person or our first black president, whoever it happens to be that week, gets in for a good beating in moralistic terms. It's such a shame. So I just think, what a contrast to those comments to, say, Pope Francis's comments. And I'm not a Roman Catholic by any means. But I think it really it illustrates something, and that is that the worst enemy of the witness of the gospel has never been the secular person. It's always been, in this culture anyway, the people who were doing outrageous things in the name of the gospel. And of course, I look very closely at how President Obama has been treated since he came to office. You know, you take away the 60 or 70% that make up the basis of the Tea Party, and all of a sudden the lies the birthers told about him not being an American go away. You take away Franklin Graham and the Billy Graham empire, and the lies about him being a Muslim go away. You take away the religious right and people like Sarah Palin and these other folks, and the lies about him coddling terrorism go away. So it is a bit much to come into the Christian the Christmas season and have Christians, you know, wailing about how they aren't allowed to put a creche up somewhere, where the real damage being done to Christianity is by folks who are speaking in the name of Christ. So, you know, I'm someone who is progressive in my political views and in my religious views, but frankly, you know, I still consider myself a Christian, not in the evangelical sense or in the literalistic fundamentalist sense, but in a cultural sense and in a sense of appreciation for big chunks of Western culture and the liberty that we have here, including women's rights, gay rights, for instance, which I think can be traced directly back in some ways to the teaching of Jesus, in terms of not picking up the stone to execute someone unless you feel yourself you've made no mistakes, or not judging others lest you be judged. These sorts of teachings ring very true to me.
Now, in terms of Christian fundamentalism in this country, and particularly the televangelical side of it, if you will, I've often thought it's really just a front for right-wing politics. And when you talk about a war on Christmas, it does seem to be a part of this kind of right-wing fraud, because the right wing in this country always try to promote themselves and portray themselves as beleaguered, oppressed. You know, Limbaugh's brother wrote a book about how oppressed Christians are in this country,
right,
which is an absurd notion. I mean, the right wing is not oppressed in this country. It's funded by people like the Koch brothers. They have unlimited funds. They,
right.
I mean, what are they talking about? And it seems to me that the war on Christmas, again, is like, what are they talking about? They just make stuff up.
Well, of course, the Koch brothers are an interesting point, because they use the foot soldiers provided by the evangelicals for their political ends, but of course they make their money in a different way. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a geologist up in Oregon. I went up to speak to a gathering of atheists and agnostics up there, mostly scientists, not that I'm a science person, but they were interested in my journey away from fundamentalism. And I was talking about my new book, And God Said Billy, which is really a portrait of religious delusion of just this kind being politically manipulated. And he was telling me something interesting. He said, hey, listen, you know, the Koch brothers are oil men. That's where they make their money. And they fund all these right-wing fundamentalist groups that are also creationists and don't believe in geology. But he said, you better believe one thing, and that is when they send out their geological survey teams to find oil, those guys believe in evolution or they wouldn't be able to find the oil. So they make their money in the oil business out of understanding how geology and the science of the planet work. But when they give their money, they're funding these lunatic groups that don't believe in evolution, that don't believe in global warming. And, you know, that's an interesting point, because it goes to show the hypocrisy in both directions. You know, the religious right talks about their biblical absolutes and their biblical views, but of course they're in bed with people who are much more dedicated to Ayn Rand and this kind of scorched earth policy against the poor, taking away food stamps, aid to dependent mothers, whatever it may be this week on one hand. And then on the other hand, you know, just out and out denying the teachings of Christ when it comes to caring for the least of these, that kind of hypocrisy. And then the kind of hypocrisy that you see in terms of what you were talking about, this beleaguered victimization, this idea that somehow poor little me, you know, our country's been taken away from us. And yet you see the last years of obstruction that President Obama has faced, and far from the country having been taken away from these folks, they've managed to reduce his presidency, you know, in leaps and bounds, and even threatened to bring both the economy and the world economy to its knees if they don't get their way, and have been in a position to do that. So The reality of the fact is that in this country you really have a war, but it's not a war on religion. It's a war by religious people on the majority. And they have been very clever in finding the choke points, for instance, the primary process in the political process of primarying candidates in the Republican Party to make sure that the whole party has been driven further and further to the right. These guys have found these choke points, and they're very well funded. They've used them cleverly. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks who follow them send the donations, whether it's to the televangelists or to the political candidate or who pressure the Supreme Court in the case of their rulings recognizing corporations as people, so that there's unlimited funding now for politics in a way we never had before. When you add all this up, the right wing has been in the driver's seat to the extent that they have been able to stymie the will of the majority, who, after all, elected Barack Obama twice. And instead of getting the agenda that he set out to accomplish, he's had to compromise at every turn just to keep the government open, to prevent these folks from literally overthrowing the government in its proper function. So this is a party of revolution. They're a party of extremists and radicals. The right wing in America has become our version of the Taliban, and one of their methods that they have for extracting, should we say, the bribe from the rest of us to keep this country going, is for us to make accommodations to them on these ridiculous church-state issues. One example being, for instance, the way the evangelical right and the Roman Catholic bishops have teamed up to present Obama as anti-religious because he had the temerity to want to provide contraception to all women who had health care plans in this country, be they corporations run by Roman Catholics or large institutions like Georgetown University or a hospital or whatever it may be. And so that's the kind of thing that we've faced, and it's a sort of an Orwellian double talk here, where you have these folks saying that they're being oppressed, but at the same time turning around, for instance, in the name of religious freedom, trying to strip women of the right to contraceptives paid for by an insurance carrier. And that would be a typical example of how in actual practice the lie has been given to the idea that they're being oppressed.
Well, let's take a brief station break, Frank Schaefer, on this Christmas Day special broadcast, and we'll be back in a moment after this brief message.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe rapture?
Well, I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my blessed Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through all trials and tribulations and my travels through the nations with my blessed Jesus I'll go far.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And continuing the conversation now with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and Sex, Mom, and God. And his latest is And God Said Billy. So how do we revive the real meaning of Christmas, for example? All we've seen now is just an unmitigated and unrelenting surge, I'll use the favorite term, surge of materialism that started with Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving used to be a wonderful American holiday where family got together. It wasn't about Hallmark cards and consumerism, but then they even opened up the stores, the Walmarts, on Thanksgiving. And then they had the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday. And since then, it's been this unrelenting materialism. And I'm wondering if anywhere in that there's any sense of what this holiday is actually originally about.
Well, you know, when you bring that up, and I know this sounds like a plug, and it is to some extent, but it just happens that this book I've written, And God Said Billy, is really about this, because it's about a young man who comes out of this kind of pro-American exceptionalism view, religiously deluded, thinks he's been called by God to go save Hollywood, moves out to the West Coast in the mid-80s, and his life, of course, does not turn out as planned because he's deluded and he thinks he's hearing the voice of God. But in the end, through many twists and turns, he winds up in South Africa trying to direct a low-budget movie, which, by the way, I experienced when I was in the film business myself before I started writing full-time. So I draw on some of that, and coming bang smack dab up against the viciousness of apartheid, which was being carried on in the name of God and Reformed Calvinist theology of the Reconstructionist kind we've had here in this country with a lot of Republican candidates like Ted Cruz, for instance, he begins to run into some things which not only make him face some realities that are unpleasant about his own beliefs, but in the end, he meets some people who you might term are real Christians, in this case a group of monks living in the desert who have renounced all this materialistic drive that we take for granted here in the West. What's interesting to me in the story of And God Said Billy and this journey is that it's obviously a parable, if you like, for the journey that both individuals and our culture are going to have to take, whether they're religious or irreligious or even anti-religious, away from this kind of material trap that we've gotten into of an ever-growing economy and this idea that everything, you know, the sense of the sacred, the sense of the beautiful, all these things have to be sacrificed to commercial interests. This, by the way, is an odd thing, but it's someplace that I think some folks on the left, the old left, you might say, the real liberal left, the non-materialistic left, and some of the right-wing people on the Christian right, but not on the hard political right, but the kind of people who are some of the homeschool moms and living on farms off the grid who are just sick of the whole system. You know, this is an area we could agree. This is an area where you've got some basic bedrock-type people out there of very diverse backgrounds and diverse political opinions who are rejecting this paradigm that we've fallen into where whether it's Christmas or Halloween or Thanksgiving or, you know, on any given Sunday with the televangelists, everything being captured by this kind of spirit. And it runs through the entire culture. It isn't just religion and religious holidays. It's as everybody knows, it's college sports that become this multi-billion dollar industry for televisions and exploitation of athletes. People aren't paid. They're not really getting educated. They're getting injured. They're never going to be, you know, NFL players. Not that you'd wish that on your worst enemy these days with the head injury situation we know about. But nevertheless, you know, every single aspect of the society we're living in now is geared towards this kind of commercial paradigm. And I think, again, where you have to fault so many people on the religious right is that surely this would be something they're speaking up on. In other words, the commercialization of every sacred holiday would be where their interests would lie. But again, because they've thrown their hat into the ring so decidedly with corporate interests, people like the Koch brothers, the oil industry, all these other people who have financed the Republican Party, the people who have fought against doing something about global warming, and all these folks, you know, you have the odd situation where the Christians who want to see a sense of the sacred at least preserved for their own religious observance have given up on insisting, for instance, on some sense of sacrament and the sacred. In what you would think, if they were taking their religion seriously, would be a big issue to them. Not so, because since the religious right has made common cause with this kind of Ayn Randian, libertarian, far right of laissez-faire business, the moral, prophetic voice of Christians in this culture has been completely compromised. Yeah, you know, you can't be in bed with the Koch brothers and then turn around and say you want the sense of the sacred restored for Christmas when big business interests and corporate interests in this country would never allow that. And so I just think, you know, it's beyond simply, you know, the Christmas and Thanksgiving holiday. I think we've gotten into a situation where, whether it's the way women look at their bodies, the way young girls look at Vogue magazine models and try to replicate that behavior through, you know, becoming anorexic, whether it's you know, this kind of fascination we have with plastic surgery and denying the fact any of us are going to get old, and we just keep marching forward looking for these quick silver bullet solutions. The American way of doing business, whether it's our holidays, Christmas, whether it's the way we, you know, look at our families, the way we underpay our teachers and think that we can have a serious educational system, you know, all these things are part and parcel of a kind of a vision of life, which is, I think, seriously off the rails. And I think it goes back to this idea of just loss of intrinsic value in beauty and these other things. So to me, the message of Christmas is very simple, and that's create beauty, give love, find peace. That's the formula. And so much of what we do in American culture today, unfortunately from the right and unfortunately from people who call themselves Christians, and corporate interests, is to do just the opposite of that. You know, we do not create beauty. We create ugliness at every turn. Right? We do not give love. We simply value everything on a kind of a monetary scale. And we certainly aren't finding peace. And so to me, you know, the message of Christmas is the opposite of this kind of commercial engine that drives these holidays. And again, I think it's ironic, going back to my book And God Said Billy, that here I've got a story about a guy who pursues this kind of delusional corporate American way of doing things out to the very limit. And then in the end, where he finds peace is in the middle of a desert monastic community, as far away from the kind of commercial spin of not just the movie business that he's been in, but also from, you know, corporate life and the way America functions. And that's obviously, to me, the message of these holidays like Christmas, is to take a moment to reflect on the fact that the things we really value in life are not the ones that are being sold to us. And I think that's the bottom line.
But Frank, when you talk about conservatives there, and it's true, this country is very right wing, and certainly they've got the megaphone, they've got the money, they've got the media on their right side. But there are certain things about conservatives that that are interesting and are ironic to point out. For example, in terms of charity, there have been various polls done that indicate that conservatives are more generous than liberals in this country.
Right.
So explain that.
Well, I think that when you get down into the bedrock of the religious content of a lot of these people's lives and where they came from, even if that's not where they are anymore, there's that sense of community that does spring out of the best of what churches offer people. And I think that tradition is very strong within the conservative circles. The problem is that, of course, it's all going off the rails as well, because let's just take one example. You have Franklin Graham, I mentioned before. Here's a guy who runs a nonprofit organization where every dime that comes in is a donation to help the poor through something called the Samaritan's Purse, which is a spinoff of the Billy Graham organization he started. And his combined salary running Samaritan's Purse and the Billy Graham Association, which he runs now for his dad, who's old, his paycheck every year is a little over $640,000 a year, plus perks. So here's a guy who's living off the donations that are coming in to help the poor from people who are very well-meaning, walking home when you add up the private plane and all the rest of it with you know, a good chunk of $1 million plus a year, which may not be much for corporate America, but it's certainly not the idea that people have when they think of ministry. And certainly, you know, ministry in terms of raising money to help poor people in the name of Christ. So I think what's going to happen, unfortunately, is that the cynicism, what you might call the Walton family, the Walmart cynicism, you know, the Waltons who hold themselves up as a paragon of this kind of good Christian Southern family, who have made these hundreds of billions of dollars off paying people minimum wage and not offering health care. You know, the problem is that this fascination with private charity and private giving from the right is, I think, a kind of a blood money that is given in lieu of actually serious efforts to help people in society. I'll give you an example. You know, one of my children, Jessica, lives in Finland, and her kids are going to school there, and their teachers are regarded as as important as doctors or lawyers. They are recruited from the best universities. They are paid salaries commensurate with practicing medicine. It's one of the most valued, esteemed professions in the country. The dropout rate of teachers is less than 1% per year. In America, it's closer to 25-30%, depending on areas that people drop out after 4 or 5 years. It's a completely different culture of education, and yet private donations in Finland are less generous than those in America because taxes are higher and people see the entire community as responsible for seriously addressing these issues. I think what we do in America, rather, you know, we're the kind of people that, speaking of Walmart, you know, underpay the employee and then put a food basket out for people who don't have enough money for Christmas dinner. That's our way of doing it. So, you know, I think if the right was serious about charity and giving in this country, what they would be doing is working for an equitable tax structure, reform of education that would recruit from our best universities with the starting salary that was high and attractive, and much more than just the money, give the kind of prestige and honor to the teaching profession that it deserves. You know, these are the kind of things the right wing doesn't do. So throwing a couple thousand dollars at your local education foundation to help buy books and pencils for a school where teachers are using their own salaries to supplement the lack of materials in inner city schools, I don't consider charity. And so I don't look at this as a great pat on the back to the to religious people or the right. I think what would be much more telling is if they would elect officials who would say, let's spend less on defense and more on education. Let's cut class size in half. Right. You know, let's make sure that everybody is in Head Start. Right. Let's provide babysitters and childcare for single mothers so that they can cope instead of taking their kids away and shuffling them off into a foster care system because we've driven them over the brink.
Right.
That to me would be much more interesting than charity. So I'm not particularly taken with the fact that the right-wing Christians give away more money than liberals when it comes to charitable donations. You know, my view is that's not the way to do it, and it's failing, because if they were serious people, they would be fighting for a culture and a structure economically that would advantage people rather than disadvantaging them.
Well, Frank Schaefer, I thank you so much for joining us here today on this Christmas holiday.
Hey, Ian, thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandmother, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and Sex, Mum, and God. And his latest is And God Said Billy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Catholic sister who works with migrant laborers in Central Florida.
Country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And on this Christmas holiday, we are joined by Sister Ann Kendrick, who is one of the co-founders of the Hope Community Center in Apopka, Florida. In 1971, Sister Ann and three other members of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Nemours moved to the area bordering Orlando and founded what was originally called the Office for Farm Worker Ministry. Since then, Sister Ann and her partners have been working to address the problems confronting migrant laborers in Central Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Ann Kendrick.
happy to be a part of your program.
And on this Christmas holiday, what are you doing and what are the members of your community doing?
Well, a lot of the farm workers in this area are Mexican or Mexican-American, and they have a beautiful, beautiful Christmas tradition in the days leading up to Christmas. And so we've been every night in different communities during this lead-up to Christmas, celebrating Las Posadas, which is sort of a reenactment of Joseph and Mary on the road and seeking lodging and seeking a safe place as Mary prepares to deliver her child. And so since this is an immigrant community, a farm worker community, a poor immigrant community, and a good chunk of the community are undocumented and have in this last year or two particularly suffered, you know, untold harassment and racial profiling simply for driving without a driver's license, because since September 11th they're unable to renew driver's licenses that they've had for 20 years or more. So it's and we don't exactly live in New York City where, you know, they can hop on the, you know, on the subway. So it's been a particularly rough year in terms of immigration. So our theme of this Posadas this year, and actually last year, has been the one of immigration and imagining that, you know, those of us of this Christian tradition, we believe in a God that actually migrated. Our God was a migrant who migrated from the all-powerful throne of the great creator to be born a humble and vulnerable child, you know, in the very poorest of circumstances, to actually immigrant parents who are on the road, as so many of our people are, and who, you know, at the moment of his birth became a refugee child and had to flee to Egypt, where I'm sure that there was not a border crossing guy looking for, you know, his mica, his green card. Or visa. So it's to try to help the people see, you know, that their migratory status and their struggle with all of this being a people on the move, you know, is something that is very known to the God of our many understandings and with great incarnational knowledge, you know, that their life is on the radar, and we care about that, and we hope and work for social justice so that their movement not be so restricted and not be so painful, and that they can find inclusion, acceptance, integration, and courage and hope and acceptance, you know, in the places that they go. So those are the themes of the Posada, as people sing En nombre del cielo. It's the pilgrims looking for asylum. And the innkeepers saying, no, no, no room. And what are the reasons that people have no room these days? You know, affordable housing, impossible. Immigration status, you know, been impossible to find common ground and work something out. The oppression of women, the oppression of people because of their skin color and skin tone. And the exclusion of people who are poor and from sectors of our society that we don't appreciate. So that's been the theme leading up to this great Christmas, you know, day. So not just some sort of little romantic story about the baby Jesus, but you know, a real life story of people's struggle on the road, and that we're all a pilgrim people, whether we wish to recognize it or not. So it's been a great time of spiritual growth, I hope, and beating back the powers of greed and economic systems and political systems that exclude rather than include. Big, long, fat answer to that question.
Well, much appreciated. And as you just mentioned, the broader issues of economic justice and in this country, and in many ways, more and more of us are living in the manger and fewer of us are living in the inn.
Right.
And that is the reality of America today. We're becoming almost a feudal country in terms of the distribution of wealth, the collapse
Absolutely.
Of the middle class, and
Absolutely.
The impoverishment. I mean, there's so many people, Walmart employees don't get a living wage, the fast food workers don't get a living wage, even bank tellers don't get a living wage.
Right,
so,
absolutely.
So what's happening to our country?
Well, I think we're slipping or maybe running into more and more, you know, a huge gap, you know, the wage gap and the wealth gap between, you know, the bottom sector and the top sector. And, you know, I think for people on the top, just the amount of benefits and perks and salary and bonuses that go to the people at the top, it's just obscene when, you know, in our community is being held together by low-wage workers who are trying to cobble together two or three jobs in order to survive. Here in this community, we have people who work in the fields all day, then at night they clean office buildings, or do maintenance and cleaning work in the hotel motel, you know, sector, and try to pick up a construction job here or there, or any sort of combination of those, you know, those things. And you know, they were hit really bad by the economic downturn. You know, if they're your lawn guy, you know, the people who clean your house and do odd jobs, and you just call them less, have them come fewer times, and so the number of people who are underemployed, who are just working very hard but unable to work in any kind of stable, you know, employment. It seems to me that we could do a lot better job in creating systems and situations where there is work for people, and it's a stable work, and it's a decent, you know, living wage. But you know, we start talking about that stuff, you know, in this supposedly generous moment of, you know, of Christmas, people are thinking about, oh, what family can I adopt? Well, do you even know a family, you know, that you could adopt? You know, we have people call here all the time. They want to adopt a family. It's a feel-good thing that they could give, you know, this family's children presents on Christmas. Meanwhile, the shamed and dejected father and mother are sitting in the next room, unable to provide, you know, any kind of, you know, sort of material surprises, you know, for their children. It's, I think our idea also of charity and, you know, and helping can just perpetuate the system rather than challenge it. You know, why don't people give at Christmas time to, you know, to social change organizations that are trying to look at some of the root causes of the economic disparities and the political stuckness of our society? But no, you know, we want to do the feel-good thing. You know, do a soup kitchen line. I'm not demeaning those things, but you know, they aren't changing things. Mm-hmm. They're helping keep the people at the bottom alive. And while we need to do that, we need to also be, you know, planning how we're going to put ourselves out of business, because our services in that way are not needed any longer.
So in terms of the materialism that you mentioned that associates with Christmas and certainly precedes it with all the shopping mania and right. gift giving, et cetera, and the shame of parents that don't have the money, and of course young children and children in general in this country are bombarded with advertising that creates these demands.
Right.
And,
right.
and it's kind of cruel that we have a younger generation now who are heavily indentured with student debt.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, we've created this generation of sophisticated consumers, but they don't have the purchasing power. So they're
right.
caught in this kind of no man's land. What's your sense of in terms of religion, Sister Ann Kendrick, of what, you know, we got the one hand, you've got the prosperity gospel on the one hand, and
right.
then you've got the real gospel on the other, and
right.
you've got the God of love and so much of the religion of hate, with awful bigotry coming from so-called Christians on television, who are now, you know, a lot of prominent people like Sarah Palin are defending this character from the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty, which is a TV
right.
reality show, who made some very, very unpleasant and nasty racist remarks. And yet he wraps himself in Christianity, and so do his defenders. So, you know, if you were an alien visiting from Mars, you would wonder what,
right?
Whose God are we talking
whose
about
God
here?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think that you know, that we've just, you know, commercialized and made, you know, the God of capitalism the Christian God. And I think people didn't really read the book. And you know, and the book isn't just static. You know, the book continues to be you know, that revelation of, you know, God continues to be explored, and you know, as in our growing, you know, sort of global cosmic consciousness. I mean, I think that those of us that really want to be on a true spiritual path, not on just a protectionism and, ooh, how can I catapult myself into the, you know, into the afterlife, you know, which sounds so unappealing to me. You know, we run the Jesus who, you know, who came to die for our sins. You know, well, how about the life part first? You know, let's talk about the beauty of life and the beauty of creation and the beauty of for those of us that are Christian that believe in, you know, a God that loved us so that became one of us, not just to suffer and die, but to live, you know, to live, to teach us how to live, how to be inclusive, you know, how to be, you know, how a spirituality of subtraction, you know, it's of diminishment, you know, and that was actually God's process, was one of emptying of oneself to become so identified and connected to the other. You know, I think those parts of our spirituality just don't get talked about too much because they're very threatening to, you know, to just personal prosperity and, you know, and to, you know, getting all of your stuff that you want and that you need. And it's, you know, even those of us who want to live in a different way, in a simpler way, you know, it is so hard in the middle of all of this. And then you work with people who are impoverished and who you know, are already so seduced into, you know, happiness comes from those things, you know. And I can sit in a place of arrogance because I have a choice. I have a choice. And, you know, people who are poor, you know, they're into forced diminishment, but there is a place in that, you know, that does touch the heart of, you know, since they can't count on anything else. But I'm not saying that that's the motivation, you know, that they still believe in a gracious God, a loving God, a God of goodness, and a God of abundance. And their generosity is amazing. You know, people who have in the material world next to nothing, you know, roll over and take in a family that's, you know, that's unknown to them. You know, come to get some toys for Christmas. You know, we do an alternative thing. We take new toys and, you know, part of me hates it, but part of me, you know, thinks it is at least a part of a solution to this Christmas mania. And we make our own Christmas store, and for 10 cents on the dollar, poor people can come and buy what they want for their kids and hide them and give it as if it was Santa or the baby Jesus or mom and dad or, you know, whatever their tradition or culture, you know, is, but it's controlled by them. And they can come and they can spend $25 or $50 and buy things that are worth 10 times that and bring them home and be able to give them, you know, to their own, you know, their own loved ones. And, you know, that's sort of a compromise. The other part of me wants to not even get involved in it at all. But we don't have toys that are violent. We don't have toys that are damaging or that are competitive. We try to have educational things and clothes and things that are useful and that are pretty and that are beautiful and are inspiring and can teach love and compassion and skills to young, you know, and to young children. So that's our little effort to try to do something different and still respond to the bazillion people that, you know, in the days before Christmas want to give us stuff and want to adopt a family. So contribute to our Christmas store, and we raise a little money to help us keep on the lights in January and February and do the alternative things that we try to do. And we allow, you know, we had 500 families that could shop at the store. And for many of them, it was the one thing that they could do in order to have some presence for their because they're working poor people that don't qualify for the giveaway things. You know, and they're people who don't get in those lines anyway because they don't think that they're poor, that they're, in, you know, that they're that needy. And they're the hardworking, working poor people who we try to help through, you know, through that. But, you know, it's just, you know, it was Thanksgiving. We were giving thanks, sort of, you know, and then it was Christmas. And the whole, you know, I think one of the beautiful parts of the Christian tradition is Advent, you know, the waiting, you know, the longing. You know, in the middle of that comes the solstice, the longest night of the year, where we honor the darkness and the creativity, the gestation, the beautiful things. And how darkness, you know, the dark shadow parts of our lives, you know, can bring us such gifts if we don't just run away from them or pretend that they're not part of who we are or what our life history is. You know, they bring us learning. Somehow we seem to learn more from the sort of the crises, you know, oops, oh my God, what am I going to do moments, the help me God moments. So I'm sad that Christmas, you know, Thanksgiving Day, all the lights are up for Christmas, and we don't get to really feel the longing, the darkness, the journey, the call for patience and belief that, you know, this is not a, you know, an instant transformation. You know, this journey of spiritual life with God is, you know, isn't a quick fix, or it isn't just a fix to our panic or to our fear. You know, it's a life process of believing in the sacred, of the goodness of creation, caring for the earth, growing in our cosmic, you know, consciousness of how we are all part of the whole. Boy, if we could really spend some time thinking about that instead of running to Walmart, to get a cheap deal.
Well, also think of the people that work at Walmart.
Absolutely.
That are surrounded by all that materialism.
Right.
And yet they can't even afford those toys for their own kids.
That's right.
I mean, that's where, right, I think. And when you consider that the Walton family, the heirs to the founder of Walmart's fortune, the combined wealth of the children of Sam Walton are the equivalent of the entire wealth of the lower 40% of all Americans.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Oh, it's unbelievable. But I mean, it's absolutely factual that the combined wealth of the seven heirs are the equivalent of the
combined wealth.
Right, of the lower 40% of all Americans.
Wow.
You know, which is what would that
be? Oh, that makes it just more horrible, more heinous. Oh, my God.
Right. And that's, what, about 120-plus million Americans we're talking about there.
Right.
So,
well, you know, I think I used to think, you know, that we were going to have this big revolutionary moment, you know, and that I might see the edge of it. And I think more now it's, you know, you dig down into a local community and you work in a practical way with people toward integration, toward diversity, toward building the community. You know, we do a lot of service learning, immersion stuff with college students. And bringing them into our community. They live with migrant farm worker families, and they work in the fields, and they live with undocumented immigrant families, and you know, which kind of blows the face of these undocumented immigrants who are criminals. And you know, it upsets their worldview and their you know, whatever stereotypical information that they had before they, you know, before they came. But it's also, it has a mutual effect, because as they live with families and gain, you know, some respect and see the dignity and the resilience and the beauty of these families, it becomes a, you know, a mutually empowering thing, where the families with whom they stay and the young people that are part of our youth, you know, program that talk to them about their life and their issues. You know, they are also, they grow in self-esteem by feeling the respect and the honor that they feel from these, you know, sort of outsiders, you know, white people, or, you know, people that aren't part of their normal, you know, social construct, who are awed by the gifts, the graciousness, the hospitality, and the hard work, and the humility of this community. And the local families feel it, so the kids and the students who come from other places also have a transformative experience, and it becomes a mutually empowering and a mutually healing thing. And so maybe the change that we're looking for is going to be like the 100th monkey, you know, with, if we just, everybody in our own little pockets, you on the West Coast, us on the East Coast, all kind of digging in different parts of the community, but working toward consciousness and goodness and receptivity and inclusion and working toward restoring right relationship in the broken community where everybody belongs. Everybody belongs. You know, someday that's going to be, you know, just in the air, you know, and enough of it in the air that we can look around and say, well, maybe we won't be still alive to look around and say, oh, my God, you know, the tipping point has arrived, and it's tipped back in the other direction. It's tipped in a way toward the direction of goodness and wholeness and inclusion. You know, maybe, you know, in the Buddhist view, right, it's 700 years is a good plan, you know.
Well, you know, when you talk, Sister Anne, of revolutionary times, there appears to be, at least some people think there's a revolution going on within your church, the Catholic Church.
Well, that would be good. Boy, we could use it.
Well, do you think that this new leader, this new pope, Pope Francis, I know on the one hand he's adamantly saying he's not going to ordain women, which is, I think, a prerequisite to make the church healthy again. On the other hand, he is saying stuff and doing stuff that indicates a different direction towards, more towards the, you know, the very prophet that the church is based on.
Right. No, I think it's a breath of fresh air. I'm very, you know, on one hand, very sort of encouraged, inspired by his direction. I think he, you know, he is a humble person whose life has been touched by people in poverty and by systems that oppress. He gets that, you know, that it's not only personal piety, but it's social change, and it's working for the community, and it's simple things. It's not just doctrinal, you know, enforcement. I think the danger, you know, is a little bit, you know, when you have, you know, an inspiring and benevolent leader, and the system is still very patriarchal and very hierarchical and not so guided by community energy and community input and community and believing really that the Spirit, you know, lives in the community of believers, not just ordained clerics. That we can back off from the need for structural change, you know, the need for institutional change. So that's a little worry that I have. You know, oh God, everybody likes Pope Francis. Ooh, so we don't have to look at. Well, not everybody likes him, but you know, those of us that believe that, you know, that we need some radical change, you know, radical in the best sense of the word, that it's root, it's back to our roots. You know, Jesus was a radical. He wasn't just, it isn't just some little romantic story that he came to jump to the cross. You know, it was his lifestyle and his commitment to poor people and to simplicity and to belief in the Spirit and in the communion of believers, you know, upset the you know, the apple cart of all the people in power in his time. And that's what, you know, I'm preaching to you, you already know that, you know, that's what brought him to his death. He didn't just come to jump to that. You know, it was his life that exacted that sacrifice. And so I think we miss that part. You know, we jump right to the, oh, Jesus died for our sins. You know, somebody told me that they were working in a homeless shelter with a unchurched, lucky for her, woman. And I think it was a Catholic nun who was saying, no, you know, God sent his only son to die for us, to save us and for our sins. And the woman said, oh my God, you believe, did the God that you believe in is a child abuser? You know, an unloving father who would exact, you know, death and murder of his only son? What kind of a God is that? It's, you know, that does kind of, you know, set, you know, kind of stop you up short, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So anyway, so much to think about and talk about in this time of Christmas. So we're talking about God becoming one of us. Wow, I think that's a pretty amazing miracle.
Well, but you also, within your church, you have the both of those strains that you just discussed, the
right.
Idea of humility and ministering to the least among us on the one hand, and then the power structure on the other.
Right.
And so do you think that the cardinals who elected this pope are having buyer's remorse?
They might, you know, but, you know, maybe, you know, I was kind of down on really believing that the Spirit worked among them, but somehow, you know, he was the guy that was chosen, you know, so, you know, it's restored my faith in, you know, that even in those sectors, the Holy Spirit can, you know, can be alive and well, and, you know, maybe people, maybe they did know, you know, kind of what they were getting, you know, and maybe... You know, maybe they didn't, you know, but I think people of true integrity, I mean, I know in the story, they say of Bishop Romero, when he was, you know, selected to be the bishop in El Salvador, it was because he'd hold the place together. It was because of his conservatism and his orthodoxy. And that is indeed where he started out. But as he, you know, as he was working with these young priests who were being assassinated, because of their commitment with the poor, and went to those villages and saw, you know, the selfless, you know, commitment of these young priests to the campesino people, to the peasant people, and to their struggle simply to live, that it wasn't an ideological, you know, debate, you know, in a classroom about what, you know, economic system do you want. It was, how can these people live? How can they survive with the oppression from the government and with, you know, and with systems, you know, of all types that oppress them? And he, his openness to that experience moved him along a continuum to where he preached, you know, against the government and against the authority of the government to order other peasant military people to shoot and kill their neighbors, and wow, that was a big shift for him. Mm-hmm. But it was a shift that happened in increments because of his life experience, and I think because he was a holy man who really was open to listening to God's call, to God's, you know, to what was God saying and doing here, and how, you know, could he understand that, and how could he be a leader of faith in that place? And so, you know, maybe that's what's going to happen with Francis, and who he says now, maybe he's not going to make any, you know, major doctrinal, you know, changes, but, you know, who knows where, you know, his life experience as a pastor dealing with people, and especially, you know, in the case of the women, you know, their total feeling of, you know, rejection and alienation and oppression, you know, even though, you know, they're the worker bees. They're the worker bees and the collegial problem solvers in a lot of places. You know, bring them in, and somehow the power shifts from who's, you know, the winners and losers to how can we collaborate together, and how can we, you know, move forward in a place, you know, where everybody has a place to stand.
Well, Sister Anne, I thank you so much for joining us on this.
No, I'm happy to. Always happy to talk to you, even though it's once a year.
Well, it's an August and wonderful day, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you take care. Thank you
too.
So much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sister Anne Kendrick, who's one of the co-founders of the Hope Community Center in Apopka, Florida, in 1971. Sister Anne and three other members of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur moved to the area bordering Orlando and founded what was originally called the Office of Farm Worker Ministry. Since then, Sister Anne and her partners have been working to address the problems confronting migrant laborers in Central Florida. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.